The foreman said, "Why don't we take a collection? It's payday. If we ask each of the men if they'll only give $10 each, we can get him buried proper with a few flowers and things like that. I've known him since he was a lad. He's never had anything. Sometimes I've thought he wasn't quite right in his head, but he always did his job, although a bit slower than most others." "Yes, that's what we'll do. We'll put a notice up above the paying out booth asking everyone to give at least $10. One of the associates said, "How much will you give?" The foreman pursed his lips and screwed up his face, and then fumbled in his pocket. He produced his battered old wallet and looked inside. "There," he said, "that's all I have in the world, until I get my pay, $20. I'll give $20. One of the men rummaged around and found amid the garbage a suitable box, a cardboard box. He cut a slot in the middle and said, "There, that's our collection box. We'll put that in front of the paying out booth together with a notice. We'll go in and get one of the clerks to write a notice for us now before the others get paid." Soon the men came in from their rounds. The barrows were unloaded from the trucks. The men parked them in their allotted places and put their brooms in the racks ready for the next day, and then chattering away idly as men and women will when in a throng they moved to the booth to be paid. "What's this?" asked one. "Our late colleague, Miller Gruber, there isn't enough money to pay for his funeral. How come you guys don't fork out $10 each at least? He was one of our own fellows, you know, and he's been on the council staff a long, long time." The men grumbled a bit and mumbled a bit, and then the first man moved to get his pay envelope. Every eye was upon him as he took it. He quickly stuffed it in his pocket. Then at the glares around him he half-heartedly fished it out and reluctantly opened one end of the envelope. Slowly, slowly he put a finger and thumb inside and at last produced a $10 bill. He looked at it, and looked at it again, turning it over in his hands. Then with a great big sigh he shoved it quickly through the slot in the collection box and moved away. Others collected their pay and under the watchful eye of all the men assembled took out a $10 bill and put it in the collection box. At last all the men had been paid, all the men save one had given $10, and he had said, "Gino, I didn't know the guy, I've only been here this week, I don't see why you expect me to pay for a guy I've never even seen." With that he pulled his cap more tightly on his head, marched out to his old car and drove off with a roar and a rattle. The foreman moved to the four men who were chiefly concerned in the matter and said, "How come you don't go and see the top brass? Maybe they'll give a bit. Nothing to lose, they can't fire you for it, can they?" So the four men marched into the offices of the senior officials. They were embarrassed, they shifted from foot to foot and mutely one of them held the notice and the collection box in front of one of the managers. He looked at it and sighed, and then took out $10. Folded it up and put it in the box. Others followed suit. $10, no more no less. At last the rounds were done and the four men went back to the foreman. He said, "Now, you guys, we'll go in to the accountant and we'll get him to count it up for us and give us a proper statement of how much it is. That lets us off the hook." Chapter 4, Gertie Glubenheimer gazed gloomily around the large room. Bodies everywhere. She thought, bodies to the left of me, bodies to the right of me, bodies in front and bodies behind, what a sick, sick lot they look. She straightened up and looked at the clock at the far end of the room. 12:30, she said to herself, lunch time. So she fished out her lunch pail from beneath the table on which she was working and, turning, she spread a book and her sandwiches on top of the body beside her. Gertie was an embalmer. She did up bodies in the funeral home so that they could be gazed at in the display rooms by admiring relatives. "Oh gee, look at him. Don't Uncle Nick look good at last, eh?" people would say. Gertie was very familiar with dead bodies, so much so that she did not even bother to wash her hands before touching her food after messing about with these bodies. A voice broke in. "Who was the stupid idiot who left that autopsy case without filling up the chest cavity?" The little man at the end of the room near the door was almost dancing with rage. "Why, boss, what's happened?" asked one man incautiously. "What happened? I'll tell you what happened," The guy's wife leaned over him to give him a fond kiss of farewell, and there was only a piece of newspaper under the sheet, and her elbow went right through into his chest cavity. Now she's having hysterics fit to bust. She's threatening to sue us to our back teeth. There was a subdued chuckle around the room because things like that were always happening and no one took such cases too seriously. When it got down to brass tacks, the relatives would not like it to be known that they had got their elbows inside their dearest just preparatory to interment. The boss looked up and came trotting towards Gertie. "Get your lunch pail off his face," he roared. "You just bend his nose and we'll never be able to do him up." Gertie sniffed and said, "Okay, boss, okay, keep calm. This fellow is a pari, he's not going on display." The boss looked at the number on the table and consulted a list he was carrying, saying, "Oh him, yes, they can't go above $300, we'll just box him up and send him off. What are we going to do about clothes?" The girl looked to where the naked body was beside her and asked, "What's wrong with the clothes he had on when he came in?" The boss said, "They were hardly good enough to put in the garbage can. Anyway, they've shrunk so much after being washed that they won't go on now." Gertie said, "Well, how about those old curtains we took down and we decided they were too faded to put up again? Couldn't we wrap him in one of those?" The boss glowered at her and replied, "They're worth $10. Who's going to pay $10 for it? I think the best thing to do is to put some shavings in the casket, dump him in, and put some more shavings on top. That's good enough, nobody's going to see him anyhow. Do that." He stamped off and Gertie resumed her lunch. Over it all hovered Mulla Gruber in his astral form, unseen, unheard, but seeing and hearing all. He was sickened at the way his body was being treated, but some strange power held him there. He could not move, he could not shift from the spot at all. He watched everything going on, watched some bodies being clothed in absolutely wonderful dresses, the women and the men being done up in what seemed to be evening dress or formals, while he thought, would be lucky to get a handful or two of shavings. "What you reading, Bert?" somebody called out. A young man with a paperback book in one hand and a hamburger in the other looked up suddenly and waved the book at the questioner. "I believe," he answered. "It's a darn good book, I'm telling you. It's by that fellow Ramp who lives in the city. I've read all his books and one thing stuck in my mind ever since. It is that you've got to believe something, because if you don't believe in anything you're stuck good and fast in the wilderness. Look at that fellow there," he gestured towards the body of old Maligriba lying cold, still and naked on the table. "That fellow is a complete atheist. Wonder what he's doing now? Can't be in heaven because he doesn't believe in it, can't be in hell because he doesn't believe in that either. Must be stuck between worlds. This fellow Rampa always says that you don't have to believe what he says, but believe in something, or at least keep an open mind, because if you don't keep an open mind, then helpers, or whatever they are on the other side, can't keep in touch with you, can't help you. And somewhere in one of his books he says that when you pass over you get stuck in nothingness." He laughed, and then went on, "He also says that when people get to the stage just out of the body they see what they expect to see. That must be a sight, to see all the angels fluttering about." A man moved across and looked at the cover on the book. "Funny looking guy, ain't he? Wonder what that picture's meant to be?" "Dunno," said the book's owner. "That's one of the things about these books, you get covers and blow me you never know what the covers mean. Never mind, it's the words inside that I buy them for." Old Maligruber hovered closer. Through no effort of his own he seemed to be guided to places, as the men were talking about the book he was sent to hover right over them, and it stuck in his mind, "If you don't believe in a thing then as far as you are concerned it doesn't exist. And then what are you going to do?" The lunch hour wore on. Some people were reading with books propped up against corpses, and Gertie had her lunch spread out on old Maligriba's body just as though he were a spare table for her convenience. At last the bell went and lunch break was over. The people cleared up the remnants of their food, balled up the paper and put it in a garbage bin. Gertie picked up a brush and brushed the crumbs off Maligriba's body. He looked down in disgust at her uncaring, unfeeling actions. "Hey, you guys there, Get that body ready immediately, toss some shavings in that shell number 49 and toss that fellow in on top of the shavings. Then put some more shavings on top. He shouldn't leak any, but we've got to make sure that everything is mopped up. The boss man again. He danced into the big room with a sheaf of papers in his hand, and then he said, "They want the funeral to be at 2:30 this afternoon, which is rushing it a bit. I must go and get changed." He turned tail and fled. Gertie and one of the men rolled Maligriba's body onto one side and passed loops beneath him and then moved him to the other side so they could get at the loops. Little hooks were pulled up to engage in eyelets, and then the body was swung up onto what seemed to be a little railway running on rods. They pushed Maligriba's body to a side of the room where what they called a shell, which was numbered 49 in chalk, was standing ready with the lid off. The man assistant went to a big bin and took out a lot of sawdust, which he poured liberally into the casket until there was about 6 inches of sawdust. Then Maligriba's body was lowered into the casket. The girl said, "There, I think he should be all right. I don't think he'll leak any. I've got him tied off all right down there, and of course I've got him plugged everywhere, too. I don't think he'll leak, but let's put in more sawdust instead of shavings, the old man won't know." So they got another load of sawdust and poured it onto the body until Maligriba was covered. Then together they lifted up the lid and put it on with a slam. The man reached for a pneumatically powered screwdriver and turned down the screws as the woman put them in the holes with her fingers. She reached out and picked up a damp rag, then carefully wiped off the number in chalk. The casket or shell was hoisted up from the trestles and moved sideways onto a wheel trolley. A purple pall was placed over it, and the whole affair was wheeled out of the workroom into the showroom and display rooms. There came shouting, and the boss, now done up as a conventional funeral director in very formal clothing, black jacket, silk hat, and striped trousers, moved on to the scene. "Push him out there, get a move on, will you," he shouted. "The hearse is out there, the door's opened and everyone's waiting. Get a move on." Gertie and the male assistant got a move on and pushed the casket along to a ramp where there was a special loading device. It consisted of a lot of rollers in a frame extending from the ramp right onto the back of the hearse. They put the casket on the rollers and easily pushed it straight into the hearse. The driver got out of his seat and said, "Okay, doke? Okay, off we go." The director got in beside him, and slowly the garage doors were rolled up and the hearse moved out. There was only one car waiting outside, a car with Maligriba's four associates in it. They were done up in their best Sunday clothes, probably clothes which had been redeemed especially from the pawnbroker. Some of these men had the bright idea that when they were not using their Sunday clothes they would leave them with the pawnbroker, because then they would have money to spend until the end of the week when they were paid, and in addition the pawnbroker always cleaned the clothes and had them neatly pressed before putting them in the hold room. Poor Maligriba seemed to be attached to his body by invisible cords. As the casket was being pushed along, poor old Maligriba in his astral form was being dragged along, and he had no say in the matter at all. Instead he was kept about 10 feet above the body, and he found himself ploughing invisibly through walls, floors and ceilings. Then at last he was moved out into the hearse, and the hearse moved out into the open. The funeral director leaned out of the hearse and said to the four men, "Okay? All right then, let's go." The hearse moved out of the funeral home parking lot, and the four mourners in the one car followed on behind. They had their headlights on to show that this was a funeral, and on the side of the following car there was a little triangular flag fixed from the top of the window reading "funeral". That meant that it could go across traffic lights and the police would not do a thing about it. They moved on and on, through the busy streets, past children playing in schoolyards, and came to the long climb up to the cemetery. There the funeral director stopped, got out and went to the car following. "Keep close to us," he said, "because at the next intersection there is always somebody trying to cut in between and we don't want to delay things too long, and you may lose the way. We have to take third on the right and first on the left." "Okay?" The man driving the other car nodded, so the funeral director went back to the hearse. They took off again with the following car really tailgating. Soon they reached the gates of the cemetery. The hearse and the following car moved in and up a driveway. At the top and off to the side there was a newly dug grave with a frame over it and the pulleys on the side. The hearse moved up, turned, and backed. Two men waiting by the graveside moved toward the hearse. The driver and the funeral director got out, and the four of them opened the back of the hearse pulling out the coffin. They turned it and moved to the grave. The four mourners followed. "This man was an atheist," said the funeral director, "and so there will be no service. That will save you certain expense. We will just lower him and cover him up." The other men nodded and the coffin was eased over the top of the rollers and special web straps were put under, then slowly the coffin was lowered into the ground. The four men moved up to the open grave as one, looked down, and were quite upset, quite sad. One said, "Poor old Maligruber, nobody in the world to care about him." Another said, "Well, I hope he's got somebody where he's going or where he's gone." With that they went back to their car, backed it, turned, and slowly drove off out of the cemetery. The two men beside the funeral director tipped a board and a whole load of earth fell into the casket with a hollow, sickening sound. The director said, "Ah well, cover him up, that's that," and moved to the hearse. The driver got in and they drove off. Maligruber hovered above powerless to do anything, powerless to move, and he looked down and thought, "So this is the end of life, eh? What now? Where do I go from here? I've always believed there was nothing after death, but I'm dead and there's my body and I'm here, so what am I and where am I?" With that there seemed to be a loud thrumming sound like the sound of the wind through taut telephone lines on a high hillside, and Maligruber found himself speeding into nothingness. There was nothing before him, nothing behind him, nothing at either side, neither at the front nor at the back, and he sped on unto nothingness. Silence. Silence, nothing but silence, not a sound. He listened very, very carefully, but there was no sound of a heartbeat, no sound of breathing. He held his breath, or thought he did, and then it came to him with a shock that his heart was not beating, and his lungs were not working either. From force of habit he put his hands out to feel his chest. There was a distinct impression that he had put his hands out, a very distinct impression that everything was working, but there was nothing there, nothing. The silence grew oppressive. He shifted uneasily, but did he? He was not sure of anything anymore. He tried moving a leg. Tentatively he tried to twiddle it, oh, but no, nothing. No sensation of feeling, no sensation of movement, no sensation that anything was. He lay back or thought he did and tried to compose himself, tried to compose his thoughts. How do you think in the midst of nothingness when you have the impression yourself that you are nothing, that you do not even exist? But then you must exist, that is what he thought, because if he had not been existing, well, he could not think. He thought of the casket being lowered down into the hard, hard earth, the earth dried out with days and days of dryness, with no rain, with never a cloud in the sky. He thought. As he thought there was a sudden sensation of motion. He looked, he would have said, over the side, with astonishment, and found that he was over his grave, but how could that be when a second ago? What was time, time, how could he measure time here? By habit he tried to look down at his wrist, but no, there was no watch there. There was no arm there either. There was nothingness. As he looked down all he saw was the grave. He saw with considerable astonishment and fright that there was long grass on his grave. How long does grass take to grow? There was every evidence that he had been buried well over a month ago. The grass could not have grown so quickly, could not have grown in any lesser time than a month or 6 weeks. Then he found his vision slipping, slipping beneath the grass. Beneath the earth, he saw the earthworms burrowing and moving, he saw little beetles bustling around. His sight penetrated further and he saw the wood of the coffin. Further he saw below the lid of the coffin, saw the mouldering, decaying mass within. Instantly he recoiled and sprang up with a soundless shriek of terror, or that was the sensation that he had. He found himself quivering, absolutely shaking in every limb, but then he recalled that he had no limbs, He had nobody there so far as he could tell. He gazed about him, but still there was nothing to see, no light, no dark, only the void of complete emptiness, where even light could not exist. The sensation was terrible, shocking. But then how did he feel a sensation if he had no body? He lay there, or should it be existed there, trying to work out what was. Suddenly a vagrant thought came creeping across his consciousness. I believe, the thought came. Grandpa, the thought came. What was it those fellows had been talking about the last time he saw them up at the sanitation depot? A number of street cleaners were there, a number of garbage truck drivers, too, and they were talking about life and death, and all the rest of it, a talk which had been generated by Maligriba showing a book by Lobsang Rampa. One of the men had said, "Well, I don't know what to believe, never did know what to believe. My religion don't help me any, doesn't give us any answers, just says you must have faith. How can you have faith when there's never any proof of anything? Any of you fellows ever had a prayer answered?" he had asked. He looked about and saw the negative shakes of his colleagues' heads. One said, "Nope, never did, never known anyone, either, who got a prayer answered. When I was a little un I got taught the Bible and a thing that stuck in my mind then was all the old fellows, great prophets, saints and whatnots. They used to pray their fool heads off but they didn't get any answers, nothing good ever happened. I mind reading one day about the crucifixion. It said in the good book that Christ uttered words on the cross, 'Lord, Lord, why hast thou forsaken me?' But he got no answer." There was an uneasy silence among the men as they looked down and shuffled their feet in discomfort, and with unaccustomed minds they tried to think of the future. What was the after death? Anything? Do bodies just return to the earth, as a putrefying mass and then as sterile bones crumbling into dust? There must be something more than this, they thought. There was a definite purpose to life and a definite purpose to death. Some of them looked a bit guiltily at their fellows as they recalled strange circumstances, peculiar happenings, and events which could not be explained by anything within their consciousness. One fellow said, "Well, that author you've been telling us about who lives downtown, well, my missus's been reading his books and she's been going on to me something terrible. She said, 'Jake, Jake, if you don't believe anything you've not nothing to hang on to when you're dead.' She said if you believe that there is an afterlife then you will experience an afterlife, it's as simple as that, you've got to believe that there is an afterlife otherwise you'll float like a bubble on the wind, just drifting about almost without existence. You've got to believe, you've got to keep an open mind so you can be ready to believe if you have something to stimulate your interest when you pass over." There had been a long silence after that utterance. The men had looked embarrassed and fidgeted uncomfortably, wondering how they could get away without appearing to run away. Maligriba thought of it all as he lay there, or stood, or sat there, he did not know which, high up in nothingness, being just a disembodied thought so far as he could tell. But then perhaps that author was right, perhaps people had persecuted him and picked on him and given him unfavorable publicity because they did not know, because they were wrong. Perhaps that author was right. Now what was it he was teaching? Maligriba strained and strained to recall the fleeting thought which had barely touched the rippling surface of his consciousness. Then it came to him. You must believe in something. If you are a Catholic then you believe in a form of heaven, peopled with saints and angels. If you are a Jew you believe in a different form. If you are a follower of Islam then you have a different form again of heaven. But you must believe in something. You must keep an open mind so that even if you do not actually believe now you still have openness in your mind so that you can be convinced. Otherwise you will float idly between worlds, between planes, float as a drifting thought, as tenuous as a thought." Maligriba thought and thought about it. He thought how throughout his life he had denied the existence of a god, denied the existence of a religion, thinking that all priests were money-grabbing Shylocks out to con the public with a lot of fairy tales. He thought about it. He tried to picture the old author whom he had once seen close up. He focused on his rendering of the author's face, and to his terror it seemed that the author's face was right in front of him, speaking, talking to him. "You must believe, unless you believe something, you are just a drifting shadow without power, without motivation, and without anchor. You must believe, you must keep your mind open, you must be ready to receive help so that you may be removed from the void, from the sterile emptiness and moved on to another plane of existence. Again Müllergruber thought, I wonder who's using my old barrow now? And like a flash he saw again the streets of Calgary, saw a young fellow this time pushing along his barrow sweeping the streets, stopping every so often to have a smoke. Then he saw the old author, and he quivered with fright as he looked down and found the old author was looking up with a sort of half-smile on his lips. Then the lips formed words, believe something, believe, open your mind, there are people ready to help you. Müllergruber looked again and felt a surge of rage at the man who was using his old barrow. It was a dirty old barrow now with dirt ingrained in the hinges of the lids and around the handles. The broom was worn, too, not even worn evenly but worn unevenly, at an angle, and that to him betrayed that the present user was not a man with pride in his job. He felt a surge of rage, and with that a great speed, frightening, mind-numbing speed. And yet it was all so strange, how could he feel speed when there was no feeling of motion? How could he have speed without the wind on his face? Then he shuddered with terror. Did he have a face? Was he in a place where there was wind? He did not know. Müllergruber just was. There was no feeling of time, hardly a feeling of being, he just was. His mind ticked over, just idle thoughts creeping across the screen of his mental vision. Then again he pictured the old author and almost heard the words which had not been uttered, you must believe in something. With that Müllergruber had a picture of his childhood, the poor, poor conditions under which he had lived. He remembered a picture in a Bible and a sentence, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want, he leadeth me, he leadeth me. The thought beat an endless refrain in Müllergruber's mind or his consciousness or whatever was left to him now, and he thought, I wish he'd lead me. I wish somebody would lead me. With his thought he felt something, he could not tell what it was. He had a sensation that people were near. It reminded him of when he had been sleeping in a doss house, and whenever any other person came by in that big room he would be aware of it, not to the point of waking but to the point of being on guard in case they tried to steal the watch beneath his pillow or the thin wallet tucked in the small of his back. He uttered a thought, help me, help me. And then he seemed to feel that he had feet. There was a strange tipping sensation, and yes, he had feet, bare feet, and with a sickening sensation of terror he found that his feet were on something sticky, dar maybe, he thought. He recalled a time when he was young and he had rushed out of the house barefooted, and he had walked straight into where the city roadman had been tarring the highway. He remembered the fright, the terror. He was very young, the thought that he was stuck on the road and would never get away again. It was like that now. He was stuck, stuck in dar. And then he thought that dar was creeping up along his body. Yes, he could feel a body now, he had arms, hands and fingers, but he could not move them because they were stuck in dar, or if it was not dar it was something sticky, something that inhibited movement, and about him he could swear there were people and the people were watching him. He felt a surge of rage, red, red rage, almost a killing rage, and he sent out the thought, okay, yaus guys, what are you gaping at me for, why don't you come and give me a hand? Can't you see I'm stuck, eh? The thought came back clear and loud, almost like some of the things he had seen on the television sets which he had watched in the windows of dealers. You must believe, you must believe. You must open your mind before we can help you, for you are repelling us with every thought. Believe, we are here ready to help you, believe. He snorted and tried to run after the people who were staring at him, for he was sure they were staring, but he found that his movements were just floundering. He was stuck in dar, movements were almost imperceptible. He suddenly thought, oh, my God, what's happened? And with the thought of oh, my God, he had seen a light in the darkness like the sunlight creeping over the horizon at the earliest part of the morning. He looked in awe, and then again experimentally mumbled God, God help me. To his delight and surprise the light brightened and he thought that he saw a figure standing on the skyline beckoning to him. But no, Müllergruber was not ready yet. He just mumbled to himself, a strange cloud, I guess, that's what it'll be. Nobody wants to help me.